Welcome back on Radio Worm for part two of Making Things Public. I'm here with Alex.
And I'm here with your son again.
We're going to be your host tonight from 7 to 8 on Radio Worm to announce our upcoming graduation show on the 29th of June, 2 days only before graduation. The opening is at 6 in / Gallery Worm, Rotterdam. Don't miss it. Stay tuned.
In the next hour, you will listen to some conversations and reflections on the research process we've been going through during our master's program. And we will also share some highlights about our graduation projects and some sonic pieces that came out of our work. Stay with us to find out more about how to make things public and to hear a bit more about our upcoming graduation show.
Enjoy the show and see you soon.
Attention, all creative minds and avid learners! Are you tired of using industrial mass-produced notebooks that do not meet your individual learning and note-taking needs? I have amazing news for you! Make a Notebook That, from Industrial Model to Tool of Expression, is a personal guide to crafting a notebook that is made to support your individual learning needs as well as an invitation to explore self-expression with an hands-on approach. You will not need much. Make a Notebook That provides you with a step-by-step instructions, engaging activities and tools to help you analyze and understand yourself in order to create notebooks that reflect your learning behavior, encourage thinking, and hopefully support your note-taking needs. Don't be scared by the lack of abilities, knowledge, or tools. Make a Notebook That is there to make making notebooks accessible to everyone. This Kickstarter kit invites users to become active makers, creators of the world around them. Imagine the satisfaction of flipping through the pages of a notebook that you've designed and assembled yourself. So don't wait! Visit the exhibition at the / Gallery Worm Rotterdam. Remember, Make a Notebook That, from Industrial Model to Tool of Expression, is there to support you in a new discovery process that will lead you to understand better your own needs and desires. Come over to the exhibition to get a grasp of what making a notebook looks like, and to get a printed publication to start your personal notebook process now!
Hello, you are listening to the graduation radio and I'm Miriam Schib and I'm sitting here with Emma Prato.
Hello, welcome to Worm Radio. I'm Emma Prato and I'm sitting here with Miriam Schib. We're going to talk about our graduation projects that will take place and will be exhibited next week on the 29th of June.
On the 29th at 6 p.m.
At 6 p.m. in the / Gallery, and we are interviewing each other here, so you can have a kind of a view of what's expecting you at the exhibition.
Yes, like a short sum up, and then you can still go and see it live. Yeah, Emma, your project. Emma is working on a project, or let's say, like, by the point you hear this, it's finished. Emma was working on a project about paper notebooks. And she was mostly looking at like how paper notebooks are made and like what kind of paper notebooks like we actually, because we usually buy very standardized paper notebooks in the store. And then she was looking at ways of like how we could actually change notebooks in a way that it also serves your individual needs, like by the use of paper, by the use of the binding, the size of the notebook, that you can kind of like personalize notebooks. Did I sum that up well?
Yeah, it's totally enough for... if you want to know more, you need to come to the exhibition.
No, but tell a little bit about like the whole background, because you are a paper notebook person, aren't you?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm more a paper person. And then XPub really brought up the need of organized paper notebooks and mm-hmm. paper notebooks that are made for specific purposes and... that are trying to follow what you need from this object and not only what everyone has. Mm-hmm. So what happened in the last month is I've been using different methods to analyze how people use notebooks, what people think about notebooks. So through interviews, through conversations, through mm-hmm. workshops that then became practical workshops where people would come, we would chat together and try to make new versions of notebooks. Mm-hmm. it's obviously a very long process, and you need to really reason on yourself and ask yourself, why did I write this here? Why am I writing in this way? I noticed how much I was writing in lists on very standardized notebooks, and I really needed, for example, folds, so then I could reconnect content, and that would really help me to reason and create new material for the research itself.
I've seen quite a lot of your self-made notebooks, and they're mostly very, how would you describe them, like for your personal use, and you say you need folds, like they are very packed with a lot of different paper, like secondhand paper, so often also already printed on, and you just write on top.
Yeah.
Then you fold the pages and make little pockets where you put things in, and like, and use an old pizza box as a cover. And, and it's really, really amazing and fascinating.
It's been very nice.
Yeah, but then in the workshops, also like some people had the need to just have a very clean notebook, and then obviously it's a way different notebook turns out.
Exactly, but I mean, this research is not trying to say no to a normal standard size. It's just about, do you know why you're using this specifically?
Yeah, and also the aspect of the ecological aspect is also important, right?
That I try always to gather materials that are that haven't been used or leftovers, or find materials in, I don't know, stationaries or printing locations, or what we have in Davidica, the trash bunker was also used in one of the workshops, and that was quite nice because people really it does really help to have a starting point, like a limitation or something. So that's why I also think that the publication I prepared for the exhibition creates limitations, and then you have to, or the user that then will become a maker needs to find their own space in these limitations and reason on why something works or something doesn't work.
So what can a person that comes to the exhibition expect to see?
Yeah, there will be this publication that is, I mean, open for sale, I guess. And there will also be a table where there's going to be a lot of recycled and leftover materials. And if anyone wants, they can sit there and make some notebooks with me.
Amazing. Sounds great.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Of course.
Let's move on and talk about you.
Okay.
So what I know about your project is, what I know you from is your amazing memes, and I really saw you into action when something happens, and you have the fastest and most creative minds to create memes that are amazing.
Oh my god, thank you.
but I think the most interesting thing is how you managed to transform such a thing that maybe from society is considered as only a funny and stupid way of mocking other people or mocking situations, or how such a thing can be a strong political tool. So your thesis already underlines or explains a lot of these things on how you've been trying to research on how you've been trying to learn from the right-wing actions on the internet, and how you research on memes and how memes have been used in the political scene, and how difficult then it becomes to be able to counteract such situations and to create strategies that can be used also by others and not only by people that know about these things.
Yeah.
Because the main problem is that people are not conscious of what's happening on the internet and what's happening politically, and how much such little stupid things are actually influencing our opinions every day.
Yeah. Yeah, I had, when I read into all this stuff of my thesis was mostly about like the alt-right's meme war in 2016, like the meme war that influenced like the US presidential election in 2016 a lot, and how memes were used as like a way of doing propaganda, and it didn't only happen back then, but it happens continuously, and it's often used by far-right people, by white supremacists, Nazis. and also other strategies, not only memes, but like just in general digital activist strategies. And I mean, if you look at the political landscape right now, and yeah, we have like, yeah, fascism is rising everywhere, and it's very, very concerning. And I was then just thinking, like, yeah, maybe we don't only have to be activists in real life, but also online, yeah, and find ways to counteract fascism online as well. So that was basically a little bit my research, and I was exploring, yeah, different ways of how to counteract fascism. It's like leftist meme making or anti-fascist trolling, because trolls exist online.
Yeah. And they're everywhere, so they be conscious.
They are everywhere. Yeah, and then my publication kind of came to be. So it, like, in the end.
Yeah, what are you gonna
what I'm gonna do, what I'm gonna make, what am I gonna show?
What are people gonna see?
Basically a website. On this website there will be, the project is called How to Be a Social Justice Warrior. Social Justice Warrior is basically a positive term that started to be used as an insult because of alt-right people that were, yeah, insulting leftists as a social justice warrior because they're so good and they're so superior and they're way too hypocrite and way too snowflake. So I think we should reclaim that term. I think we should all be social justice warriors, because social justice is a good thing. So there's this website, and you will find these little guides. Yeah, basically,
like educational pieces.
Yeah, it is an educational piece. It's on one hand, it explains a lot like what is happening. On the other hand, it also illustrates some ways to actively like engage against what is happening.
Yeah.
Then you will be able to print those little guides yourself from the webpage. If you don't want to print it yourself, you will find also some printed publications in the blob shop at the exhibition. So you can also have a physical one if you want, but it's easily accessible for everyone online for free.
Will there be memes?
There will be memes on the website. There are also memes, and also at the exhibition I will make some meme stickers, and yes, there will be memes. Yeah, and in the meantime, by the way, my meme page at Xpub Memes, I guess I will need to say another person to continue this account, because I will now graduate from Xpub, so I don't think I will continue Xpub Memes. So if anyone hears this and wants to continue Xpub Memes, then
and if you don't know about it, go on Instagram and check it out.
It's very much Xpub related things, but yes.
I mean, if you want to get into Xpub.
Yeah, if you want to get into Xpub.
Understand the vibe.
Yeah, understand the vibe. For the rest, it would really make us happy if you would come and check out our work.
Yeah.
Should we repeat again? 29th of June.
At 6 p.m. There will be performances, activities, a shop where you can buy different things. And there will be us.
Yeah, did we say where it is? /gallery
at Worm in Worm. Rotterdam.
In Rotterdam.
Netherlands.
Netherlands.
Europe. World.
Globe. Okay. Thank you, Emma, for your time.
Thank you, Miriam, for your time.
The radio interview part. And thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
Goodbye. Are you passionate about equality, justice, and dismantling oppression? Do you believe in the power of collective action? Then How to Be a Social Justice Warrior is just a guide for you. How to Be a Social Justice Warrior is an educational online hub that dives into the digital strategies employed by fascists and shows you how to counter them. In today's digital age, the battle against fascism extends beyond the streets. When sock puppet trolls are paid to spread disinformation online and white supremacists are manipulating elections by means of memes, it's time to take a stand, raise your voice, and become activist, not only on the streets, but also online. How to Be a Social Justice Warrior is your roadmap to combating hatred, discrimination, and far-right propaganda on social media platforms.
Discover strategies, tactics and principles to counteract fascist ideologies wherever they arise. With real-world examples, how to be a social justice warrior empowers you to identify, address and dismantle oppressive structures. One tweet, post and comment at a time. Check out the website packed with printable guides, memes and educational material that equip you with tools to combat far-right extremism and cyber-toxicity from the comfort of your own home. By printing these guides, you can create physical copies to share with friends, family and colleagues, spreading awareness and hopefully sparking conversations that challenge bigoted narratives. If you don't want to print yourself, be sure to check out our selection of printed versions available for purchase in the Blob Shop. Don't miss out on this invaluable resource for anyone committed to creating a more just and equitable world. Visit the website or get your copy of How to Be a Social Justice Warrior at the XBAP graduation show at the Slash Gallery. Be a social justice warrior. Inspire change. Disclaimer. While How to Be a Social Justice Warrior provides valuable insight and strategies to combat fascism, I cannot guarantee its complete eradication. Fighting fascism requires sustained collective effort, systemic change, and engagement across multiple platforms. Use this publication as a resource to support your journey, but remember that the battle against fascism extends beyond its pages.
Listening to Making Things Bub-Bub-Bub-Black on Radio Worm.
It's not a problem of getting people to express themselves, but rather force them to express themselves. What a relief to have nothing to say, the right to say nothing, because only then is there a chance of framing the rare, and even rarer, thing that might be worth saying. This is from Deleuze in his book called Negotiations.
I'm not going to be able to do that. Thank you so much. Thank you. yourself with a voice that was sweet between what sounded authentic to me and what felt right and acceptable to you.
Thank you that you make me feel alive. Thank you for your love. Thank you for being here and listening to me.
You are listening to Making Things Public on Radio Warm.
Hey, how are you? I hope you're doing well. What you're about to hear is the recording of phone calls that I had with my friends. While working on my graduation project, Minor Stories, I wanted to reach out to my friends
friends who all left Korea, now living in different countries, speaking different languages. So I picked up my phone, hoping to catch up and reconnect. I hope this noise finds you well.
Hello?
Yeah.
Oh.
Hello.
언니.
What?
안녕. 잘 들려? 잘 들리나요?
응.
아, 반가워.
반가워. 어디야? 집이야?
아니, 나 학교.
왜? 아, 왜긴 뭐.
왜긴 오늘 수업 있어.
지금 쉬는 시간이야?
아니, 오늘, 아, 수업은 아니고, 그, 슈퍼바이저랑, 뭐지? 졸업 관련해서 이제 일주일에 한 번씩 혹은 2주에 한 번씩 만나서 체크인을 하거든. 그거 관련해서 이따가 3시쯤에 만나야 돼.
그렇구나. 스트레스 받아?
아, 그랬어. 그러고. 에. 어머, 언니.
무슨 일이야?
상현 언니.
왜, 왜, 왜?
나 졸업해.
어, 드디어?
어.
나 거기서 죽은 줄 알았잖아. 졸업 못해서.
아니야, 이제.
다행이야. 축하해.
아이고, 감사합니다. 언니, 잘 지냈어?
잘 지내지.
보고 싶어.
그니까. 너 한국은 갔었니?
나? 아니, 여보세요. 아, 큐리링.
재영아.
응?
잘 지내?
아니. 우리 나 졸업해.
너 졸업해야지 이제. It's about time.
아, shit.
너 언제 졸업해?
나 6월 29일.
아, 진짜? 아니.
아니, 왜 6월 중순? 여보세요.
대박.
정지수.
잠깐만, 두 사람이 한 사람이야.
나 한 사람. 무슨 말이야?
무슨 말이지?
지수.
어. 잘 지냈어.
아니. 지수, 나 졸업해. 아니, 오늘 아니고 곧 6월 29일에 졸업 전시 열어.
와, 벌써. 아, 재영아.
안녕.
나 핸드폰 꺼져가지고.
아이고.
노트북으로 봤다.
그랬구만. 놀랬겠다.
아, 근데 나 요즘 진짜 정신 나갔나 봐. 이런 일이 자주 있어.
아, 어떡해. 언니,
자주 나도 아니고
그래.
한 달에 한 번씩 있는 것 같아.
그림, 나 지금. 내가 그래, 약간.
너도 그래?
네, 일단.
거 같은데? 나 진짜 이해할 수 없어. 아, 근데 내가 약간 정신 놓고 사는 것 같긴 해.
여보세요? 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 잉?
Hey again, this is Gersant, one of your hosts on Radio Worm tonight. We're almost done with today's program. Coming up, a conversation I had with Harriet Rose Morley on the 1st of June about Shells We Build. Here is a bit of context before you listen to a short collage of our conversation. A few months ago for our graduation show, Making Things Public, I decided to not display most of the shells I had built in the past months as part of my social chef project. For me, this is a way to take a position, to draw attention to the process rather than to the outcome. As an alternative and to pull people into the material narrative of the project, I decided to initiate the construction of our show's shelving with my classmates reusing already existing materials. A chain reaction led us to collect leftover materials from the shelving and furniture Harriet has built in May for the ultra-dependent public school that we're hosted at back in Utrecht for a few months. We talk about shelves we built, we talk about shelves we share, the shelves to come, and we reflect on our material experience as artists and makers. Stay tuned, you're listening to Making Things Public on Radio Worm.
As well, it's like you're inviting people to engage with something, so you also have to take what kind of engagement that is.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, but it's also really nice, I think, in your sense, that it's not necessarily about the outcome, it's about the process of understanding what's needed in the space.
Yeah.
So actually the kind of core of it is actually understanding the needs of the potential user.
Yeah.
It's more about the process of thinking about what's needed or what's not needed. It's more the work, maybe more the relationships built through that than the outcome is something that
exactly.
is a product of that.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily it's like a reoccurring theme, but it doesn't necessarily mean that's the end work. Hence why you're not thinking about what do I show in the exhibition per se.
Yeah.
Maybe isn't the work itself, it's more like the process of understanding what's needed. Like it's that middle space, it's that intangible space.
Create excitement also from things you have and like their potential.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really like shifting the perspective from, you know, like the end justifies the means, but actually no, the means justify the end.
Exactly, and I think a shelf is such a common object.
Mm.
It's a very, it's the same, it's these kind of core support structures, such as like tables, chairs, shelving. It has a certain understanding of purpose, therefore there's this kind of, people can associate a lot more with what the potential of that is,
yeah.
I think, than kind of maybe other sort of design objects, especially, yeah, I like this idea of, yeah, what feels more understandable now is this need for the reused materials and how, also, like, yeah, the way where the materials have come from, or even or not come from, if they're scrap or not scrap,
yeah.
is still kind of a purposeful decision process in that. It's not just because we can get this material for free, or we can get this material free, which is great, but it's also this purposeful, organic life to what the material maybe functioned for in the past.
Yeah.
Towards the future, it makes a lot more sense and a lot more. It fits way more thematically, I think, than building from brand new or building from... Yeah, it makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. And it's really exciting. I mean, I think it's also just the timing of... So what we would use for the shell structures or overall furnitures of
mm-hmm.
the show do come from a similar background. And I like that it's like this cycle life also. How do we...
I think... Yeah, the shelves at back are such a good instinct. I mean, it was interesting because this idea of usage and understanding of the space is kind of how I approach that work, in the sense that in back I've been a host. So I was, when I first moved here, I worked as a host voluntarily, like, you know, just welcoming people to the space.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I first got to know space, and then I had my graduation project there as well, so I also got to know space a lot more from the perspective of student and graduating there. And then I was asked, so there's this kind of multi-layered understanding, or kind of this idea of what's fit for purpose, what's needed for the space of back, and having this understanding of how it's used, how it's just functions or doesn't function, and all these kind of quirky little kind of niche things, such as, oh, the ugly wall, which is the wall that the shells are on, but it's the ugly wall in a fond way, because it's like probably the most beautiful wall. It's kind of scrappy, it's got paint coming off it, but it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. So I think when I was asked to do that particular work, and also like referring to like hopscotch, and then who was going to be, I met, like, Clara made me meet, which is understandable, every single person that would have some kind of attachment to that shelf.
Yeah.
So I met Hopscotch, I met BB, I met every single person, and it was exhausting. But it gave at least some understanding of what was needed to make the space fit to use. But then also going into it, there's also this idea of offering certain parameters, and then letting the parameters go to see how people take ownership over it. So in the same way that you have these different shelves, or how you see them deemed to be used, actually might not be deemed how people could use them.
Yeah.
So in the same way as the public one, you've also dictated it's on the bench. Someone might see it and go, oh, well, I think it could be hooked on the back of the bench.
Exactly.
So it's also this kind of life after life of these objects, which is never, you're never going to dictate what happens. And that for me is often the most exciting thing, to see how people take ownership over these things, how they involve into their own, they have become autonomous, their own autonomy. But then I'm also really interested in kind of the value of the technical labour that goes into it, and that is often the hidden aspect. So what you're showing also is, there's a lot of technical thought that's gone into it. I think that has also an equal amount of, has an equal importance, because you're not only thinking about the function of it, but you're also thinking about the technical steps to get to that function. So it has this, like, so many different points of, like you said, it's not a product. I think if it was a product, it'd be a lot easier.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
you're not
exactly
interested.
Yeah,
we're not interested. I know you're not interested in it being a product. We're not interested in
this. We're very romantic.
Yeah.
This way.
But then it's also super, it's super complex and super. Then how do you define the ownership of those objects? Like, how do you define your ownership of these shelves? Like, for example, you've been commissioned to make certain shelves for certain people. How do you see your relationship to how those shelves, like, live on? Like, these are the questions, at least I ask myself. Like, how do I understand, how do I define my own ownership towards certain things? Ownership to the object, to the owner who looks after it, who uses it, the functionality of it works. But then the deviation of it is still there's, it's in between, it's just like in between those. So this idea of the caretaker, the permanent caretaker, taking on the ownership and the caring of that work means in some senses that there's an obligation to, there's some kind of obligation to maintain, upkeep.
Yeah. Exactly.
And care for the work in the future.
Yeah. Well, and I think for me this year, and that's why I'm actually even feeling even stronger about not displaying it, is for me they really were part of a research, and they're really sketches of that research. And I don't see at all these objects as end products.
Mm.
Like, for me, they were, each object led to another one and led me to do the next one differently. They're not at all like final
outcomes. No, yeah.
And in that sense, actually, I'm very excited that they're already in context. Like, it's something I took from my previous study at Rietveld, where I did very performative objects, like I wouldn't tell them superficial, maybe superfluous, like they're very artistic objects, they spend a lot of time and labor on them, they're unpriceable, they're impossible to sell, like, for me, because they're just so contextual to the works that I've made, and I really critical of that. That's actually something I went into the masters being like, I don't want to spend that much money on anything anymore. I don't want to create objects that have no place to land, that are meant for fictional spaces. I'm so happy to finish the year, and actually, like, there is this friction moment where I'm like, oh, I have a show, and actually I did works that don't work in a gallery space, so I don't want to show them, but actually it's amazing that they all where they belong, because I'm having constantly conversation with students at Rietveld that have, after the exam, to figure out where to put their things so they don't have to trash them. And that, to me, is something, the obsolescence of works, I'm really, really
frustrated
against,
about.
Yeah, I'm really frustrated and against.
Yeah, this is interesting because I had the same complexity when I was graduating, because I felt like I had to jump through the hoops of showing in a show, which I wasn't necessarily interested about because the work felt so research based and also so informed by our relationships, the show with Olga, the relationships and the workshops. Like, it was so research based and process heavy that I felt like this begrudgingness to show work in that context.
Yeah.
I also felt a real complexity about authorship. I didn't also want to make something that had no function, so, but you were more interested in the process of actually learning how to work with the material, learning what's possible with the material, learning the relationships that are involved in working with that material, and then hopefully the outcome will be nice.
I think we're built to make in very unrealistic ways, and this matter of authorship, I'm also very sensible. I even have now still a complexity on how do I address my research, because I have such different political and social contexts. I don't want to, it's related but it's not, so I'd rather not mention the place, not because I'm ashamed or anything, but because I don't know how that touches to their activities. So I'd rather not mention the names but the context and the situations, because it's more about this than about this specific space, even though the objects have been made
for the space. It's not about it being part of a squat per se. It's not about the activist actions of the squat itself. It's about the input and understanding the needs of what these people need at a certain
time.
Exactly,
in this context, which could apply to other places, but doesn't have to. And I think there's this complexity that also made that I personally, in this situation, I don't think, I don't claim any authorship over these objects. Because for me, they are like more exercise, ideas, questions.
Yeah, like these items or objects are almost like the slag off, like they're byproducts.
The shells you build it back. The height of it is insane.
I know, it's
ridiculous. But in this context, it makes complete sense.
Yeah.
But in any other context, probably someone would have thought, but what's the point if you
have
not reached that?
Yeah.
But then the fact that it also now has to keep it, would you have made that decision if they had kept it in the space longer, you know?
Well, I think the shelves, I do also feel sorry, but the shelves in some way were also this protest against this idea of, like, there's this idea of the institution, like, Clara kept going on to me about this idea of the strangler fig, like, I had, like, a long meeting about all these different inspirations and references, and this idea of the strangler fig, like, attaching itself onto institution walls and climbing up the walls. I really like this idea of, and also having these questions like, can I do that? Can I do that? And they're going, yeah. And I'm like, okay, cool. So I can drill into these walls. Yeah. And then I can anchor onto the floor. Yeah. I was like, okay, cool. Because often when you're in a space, you're like, oh, you can't do this. You can't drill into this wall. You know, you've got to keep this good. Like, this has got to stay pristine. Or you can't drill into this wall because of, like, you know, it's a rented building, blah, blah, blah. So actually given that freedom, this kind of climbing structure, central to the space, like, I think, yeah, I mean, to be honest, you should have seen, we were going to even go even higher at one point, and then we thought it was a bit too much. Like, I think that's a bit too much. So in a way, it was a sign, it was like a protest of, like, attaching, leeching onto the walls of the institution.
Yeah, for the graduation show now, I wanted to, like, save or, like, get material somewhere.
Yeah.
That would fit the project also.
Yeah.
Like, now the next challenge after we get these materials back to Rotterdam is how do we use them in a way they can still be used after the show?
Yeah.
Because sometimes you also, like, butcher materials in such a way that...
Totally, that they're unusable at certain parts of it. Kind of ironic you call, because I'm actually with Gaston right now talking about leftover materials. And the possibility of them going, well, yeah, we've had a conversation about them going to the X-Pub exhibition, and I'm absolutely happy about it, so.
Thank you for staying with us. We hope that we will see you at our graduation show opening on Thursday, the 29th of June at 6 p.m. at Slash Gallery in Worm. And before we say thank you and good night, we would like to share with you what we mean by making things public and say a few words about what brought us to this title.
Graduating students of the Experimental Publishing Master, EXPUB, the Pietzwart Institute, invite you to Making Things Public in Slash Gallery, Rotterdam. A glimpse of a moment. We look at where it comes from, this bubble. Thinking about bubbles helps to reimagine publishing, or publishing. When we switch the first letter of public, publishing, and publication, something awkward happens that initiates a thought process. A small detail, a single letter, makes unfamiliar and curious again what we have learned to take for granted. Making Things Public is, amongst other things, a graduation shop and a space to continue conversations on how we sell and distribute published matter as independent makers. We are thinking about how to send out our bubbles. Our publishing has happened underwater. Throughout the past 2 years of collective study, we have experimented with and developed our works. This is a bubbling of our experience, an intimate and collective process that now travels up and out to an external public. A bubble is fragile and temporary. A bubble is created with care and consciousness. Or it emerges in a happy accident. A bubble is an imaginary intimate space. A bubble pops and spreads without a trace. A force brings us together as a group. This force will disappear, pop, like a bubble. We hope to remember its rainbows. That was a long day, huh, when we wrote this.
Yes. But it really made some nice conversations and thoughts about how do we publish, where does our work go after we part with it, and
yeah,
how does it reach out to people.
Yeah, it's really interesting how somehow this bubble metaphor emerged, and I think we all agreed that it wasn't necessarily directly connected to the bubble as a thing, but just to shift, this shift in language just enabled us to talk about it in a more, not necessarily detached, but taking a step back. We just had a better overview somehow of our work as a group using that term.
Yes, and we'll be there at Slash Gallery to have these conversations with you as well, so please pass by, because we would love to talk about publishing and art school and what happens afterwards. So join us for some conversations and some nice moments. The opening is on 29th of June at 6 p.m. at Slash Gallery in Worm.
Where?
Gerson Srellings.
Gian Hake.
Cheong. Che. Cheong. Cheong. Cheng Cheng. Kim.
Camo.
Kimberly Kusmilov.
Erika Gargaglione.
Mizzo.
Emma Prato.
Sopisera Bura Pachaisi.
Aonik.
Miriam Schöb.